Is the Heathrow Airport really situated in London? If so, how can you transit from there without a British visa? Why is the aviation industry full of quirks? Why does the light in an aircraft dim before landing, but get brighter when you lock the lavatory door? Why does every airport look alike? In this episode, we shall explore the answers to some of those questions and a lot more. Welcome to the WorkBrain podcast.
I'm Preeti Kothamarthy. I'm a behavioral scientist and I love all things related to understanding human behavior.
I'm Anupam Krishnamurthy. I'm interested in applying behavior science to solve real-world problems. At the WorkBrain, we explore how we can apply interesting ideas from psychology and behavior science to our work lives. In the second season, we derive inspiration from the design of everyday things. In our last episode for the season, we discuss the quirks of the aviation industry and try and unpack the behavioral design that lies behind them. As behavioral science enthusiasts, you bet that this long list of oddities in the aviation industry got us interested. On digging deeper, though, we realize that almost every peculiarity you notice in airports and in airplanes are there by design. This naturally makes it a hotbed for behavioral science. But before we dig into the concepts involved, Preeti, what is your take on air travel? When you think of going to the airport to catch a flight, what is the state of your mind?
To be very honest, I am like my older generation, so I would want to go to an airport earlier rather than late. So if my parents tell me you should be there 3 hours before time, I will make sure I'm at least there 2 hours before time. And partly because I'm worried about being there on time, but mostly because I like roaming around in airports, checking out duty-free shops, and, you know, just hanging around observing people. So I actually really enjoy the whole vibe of an airport.
Yeah, one thing, now that you mention it, one thing that a lot of old people like about airports is that printed ticket, which thick cardboard. So do you also have that sense of interest?
No, actually no. I think that comes more from my inclination for being environmentally sound. So I don't have that. I don't print out tickets.
I guess that's where the line is drawn.
Yeah, I think that's where I'm no longer a part of the older generation. But I'm sure as a consultant you've had your up in the air moments.
Oh, yes, yes. In fact, when it comes to air travel, I have like three phases in my life based on how I feel about air travel. The first one is, you know, before I was a consultant, air travel mostly meant vacations. And the airport was a gateway to a new experience. That's why I look forward to every airport visit with a sense of excitement. And then I turned into a consultant and all of this excitement turned into a routine. Yeah. More so a 4 a.m. Monday morning routine where you have to wake up that early to catch a flight week after week. Yeah. And then I started associating visits to the airport with heightened stress levels.
I can totally imagine that.
Yeah. So when I decided to quit consulting, I had enough of airports. But then there's this third phase where I've not visited an airport or I've not used an airport in a year and a half now. So now I've gone back to missing air travel. I feel like a prisoner in my own city because, I mean, like a lot of us do, given the kind of times that we're facing.
Yeah.
But it kind of comes to show that we live in the luxurious and abundant 21st century and that I have turned into a spoiled creature.
That's true. In fact, now that you mention it, I stay in Singapore where the island itself is quite small. So the reason people stay in Singapore is so they can travel. And this last 1 year of no travel has really put people in a weird spot. So airlines like Singapore Airlines actually introduced a flight to nowhere. They had to cancel it because of all the backlash about carbon footprints. But they do still have this option where you can sit in a flight and eat an airport meal, aircraft meal and come back. So that you don't miss the meals online too much.
Wow. Okay. So the flight to nowhere is a flight that just goes around in the air and comes back and lands in Singapore, is it?
Right. Yeah. But then they had to cancel that. That never took off.
Right. So that never took off in both senses.
Yeah.
But the airport, I mean, the aircraft meal is still interesting because most, for the most part, people criticized aircraft meals and it still gets a bad rap for several reasons.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting how people come to miss even that experience about flying, which they complained the most about previously.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's move on to the first part of this topic, which is about how airports, I mean, it goes back to that quandary that I had about how you can go to the Heathrow airport and transit from there without having a British visa. So if Heathrow is in London and you're able to visit London without a British visa, how is that even happening? Now, there are spaces in the airport which are actually non-places. And that is what our first topic is about.
Yeah, I found this whole concept of a non-place very interesting. It comes from a lot of anthropology and ethnographic studies where someone called Mark Orsch actually defined places and non-places. So a place is a space that is relational, historical, and identical. A non-place is the opposite of that. So that means it's non-historical, it's non-relational, and it is not concerned with identity. So airport actually is like probably one of the most common examples of non-place because it completely fits the description. An airport is something which is generally far away from the actual city. If you imagine the structure of any airport, it will generally have two sides. There's one side which is actually facing the city or the main part of the country that you are visiting. Mm-hmm. And then there's the other side which is facing the runway, and it is generally very pale. And it almost looks like it's very like it's rooted, like there is nothing else around it. And you have a sense that this could be anywhere. So the view that you get by staring out at the runway is a view you could be getting in Heathrow, in Rome, in India. Anywhere you could be staring at a runway and get the exact same view. So using that as a context, Mark Orsch calls this a non-place because it's non-relational. You could be anywhere. It doesn't matter which country you are in. It has no identity. It's just a pale side that's looking out at the runway, which I thought was a very interesting ethnographic way of defining a place or a non-place.
We've thought about places all our lives, but I've never actually paused to think what is a place.
Exactly. And technically speaking, also, if you think about it, once your passport's been stamped and you have passed through the metal detector, you're actually nowhere. You are neither in the country of departure nor in the country of destination, which actually explains why it is possible for you to transit through Heathrow without getting off, because you are basically just going from one non-place to another and just staying in the non-place area and taking the next flight.
So you don't have, by any stretch of imagination, you don't have bragging rights that you visited London if you transited through Heathrow. Yeah. You know, when I was a kid, I used to take these long train rides across the country, across India, from the north to the south. And I would get down at each state and said, now I've set foot on Madhya Pradesh. Now I've set foot on Rajasthan. But, you know, I can't really do that in Heathrow. And this really burst my bubble.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's how it is.
And this theme of it being a non-place has actually been exploited by Hollywood, like most teams are.
Yeah.
And have you seen that movie, that movie called The Terminal, which came out in 2004?
Yeah, absolutely. One of my most favorite movies of all time.
Yeah, it's such a great movie. Tom Hanks is my favorite actor as well. And it was a movie whose entire plot revolved around this fact that in the terminal of New York, where, you know, he's neither in the legal part of the United States, nor is, and also the character inside that Tom Hanks plays turns stateless because his passport gets canceled for some reason. And he doesn't have a valid visa and is forced to spend 9 months in JFK. So, I mean, you know this movie. You've seen the plot.
Yeah. I think I read somewhere that this was actually based on a real life story as well. I mean, obviously, it's been exaggerated a lot for the movie.
Preeti, you've heard this saying that truth is stranger than fiction, right?
Yeah.
So the inspiration for the story came from this gentleman called Mehran Karimi Nasiri.
Yeah.
And he's an Iranian who was rendered stateless. And he spent some time in the Paris Charles de Gaulle airport.
Hmm.
And this was around 2006 when he actually got out of the airport. But can you guess how long he spent there?
I'm guessing maybe a few weeks.
He spent 18 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
18 years at CDG.
Wow.
Until finally he, you know, due to health-related issues, they forcibly evacuated him there from there.
Yeah. Okay.
And now he lives in Paris.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So coming to this non-place, I mean, like, in terms of what are the implications? So what if it is a non-place? What does that, how does that manifest itself?
I think the importance of being a non-place comes out in the fact that it means that every airport around the world is a non-place. So they sort of have a shared culture of their own, which means iconography or how people find their way around, the kind of things that should be in an airport. These are similar across all airports. So they're non-places, but they're connected in the fact that they're non-places.
Ah, so that kind of explains the homogeneity that we find in terms of the check-in, the security, and how the airport is laid out, how the non-places are laid out.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that is something that will, I mean, even through the episode, this will keep coming up again and again, how across various airports we would find similar design. But that actually, the fact that they all have similar design comes from the fact that they have a shared culture, which is that of not being a place.
Wow. Okay. Even the lack of, you know, ethnographic association can give rise to culture. So
yeah,
that's what you're coming to see.
Yeah.
You mentioned about how there is no identity associated with the airport, and I mean, with those spaces in the airport, and that's why they turn into non-spaces. But despite not having identity, what we see is that they are identical in several respects.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, it's so funny, because when you often transit on long-haul flights, it kind of fail to remember where you transited from. And that is, for me, also an essence of a non-place. The place that you visit, but you're not able to recall.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it is so merged in its identity that you cannot even differentiate it in your head.
Exactly. Exactly. Fascinating. So, I think it's very difficult to draw parallels or applications from this, because it's one of a kind, but it's very interesting, again, from a behavioral science perspective.
I think the other way to look at it, and it's probably a very philosophical way of looking at it, but the idea that non-places also have a shared culture, that in itself says a lot. And it means that people don't always need to rely on a culture to be able to do things. And if you actually imagine that in the context of anything we do, so for example, how is everybody in any part of the world able to use Google or any app that's like, for example, you don't need tutorials to learn how to use Facebook, right? You'd open it and you just intuitively know what's where and you start using it. I think what I'm trying to get at is that it's not just non-places, but that in general, I think for a lot of things now in our life, we have reached that point where across cultures, people are able to, thanks to design and to ethnography and how things are presented, we have come to a common reference point, which actually helps us navigate through most situations, which probably wasn't the case a few years back, but now makes it easier thanks to technology.
And I think it's also an aspect of technology that is going into the very essence of what it means to be human, right?
Hmm.
Because if something can be universally adopted, it has to go that deep into your, into the kind of, and like the only thing you have in common with somebody else on the other side of the world is that you're the same species, you have the same, whatever it is that makes you the same species, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's known that art like Beethoven and Mozart can be enjoyed universally. It's been studied to show that. And now we are also converging on similar lines of technology. So now let's switch gears to the second part of the episode, where we talk about environmental design. But as we do this, let us actually imagine that we are going into an airport and going through all the different stages that are needed to catch a flight that we have that is taking off maybe in an hour. Or in Preeti's case, it'd be 2 hours because she gets to the airport early. So what are some of the environmental design aspects that we see as soon as we enter an airport?
I think the first thing that you would notice as soon as you get to an airport is the fact that you never have to find your way. Everything is like directionally oriented. You know that as soon as you get in, there will be check-in counters or there'll be kiosks where you can check in. As soon, even while you are doing that, there are those queues for which they've already put markers. So you know exactly where to go. Once you have done that, you don't even have to look around. You know that the next step you take will already be in the direction of security check. As soon as that is done, you know there will be immigration. And after that, you'll enter the duty-free. And you don't have to find your way through any of this because everything has been arranged in a way that just guides people towards that. So in that sense, the wayfinding has already been sorted out for customers and it doesn't matter which airport you're in. This is the process and you'll be herded towards the gates without even realizing that you're actually going through all of these processes. And even that aside, like we were talking earlier, things like basic things like toilets, duty-free shops, departure gates. I mean, all of those are visually mentioned in some or the other form, either through icons or through numbers, in ways that are so easily understandable to people that irrespective of cultures, everybody gets what's being said. So the language is mostly non-verbal, but it is also accessible, just like as simple as traffic signs. Like you would get it without even knowing.
Yeah, you're forced to rely on universal communication symbols and rituals. I think one of the main aspects about airport is because there are so many people from so many different cultures and languages that are using this space or non-place that you're forced to think really hard about these aspects of environmental design in terms of making it universal in some sense.
Yeah, and one of the things that I really like about how airports do this is the fact that you don't have to, like a person who's going through an airport doesn't need any pre-existing frame of reference. You can like walk into airport for the first time and yet be able to navigate because whatever is represented there is irrespective of your original frame of reference. In its current frame, it makes sense and that's all you need to know.
And this is a concept that we also touched upon during the supermarkets episode.
Yeah.
But the scale is completely different here in the airports. Yeah. On the one hand, the space is much bigger. And also, supermarkets rely on social norms.
Yeah.
Whereas here, you're forced to rely on human norms because there's probably nothing that connects them connects the different people who are using it socially.
I was going to say, the other interesting aspect about airports is the fact that you have to rely on time a lot. Because time is a scarce commodity. Everybody has an end point. You have to make it to the gate before time. So because of that, the way time is shown in airports is also very different. So when you're looking at a board that's showing you how to get to your gate, you'll realize that a lot of times it's actually shown in minutes and not in distance terms. So your gate would be 5 minutes away or 14 minutes away. Because they realize that when you are in the airport, you're stressed about getting to your gate on time. So converting the distance into minutes ensures that passengers actually don't have to stress about that. They can easily figure out how much time it will take them to the gate. And that, I think, is actually a perfect example of how you can use existing mental models that customers have. Because even if you had shown the distance, somebody would actually still end up converting it to time. So by showing it in time, you've actually made it so much easier for customers.
I think you're taking an abstract concept, a slightly more abstract concept like distance, and you're converting it into something more tangible like time, right?
Exactly.
That's kind of what's happening when you're saying instead of the gate is 300 meters away, it is, it's 5 minutes away.
Yeah. And there are lots of applications of this. And this is something that I always tell communication people about, that you have to think in customer mental models. You can tell people that a bottle of Coke has a lot of sugar in it, or you could just show a bottle of Coke equivalent to 6 donuts. If you say it's equal to 6 donuts, people it's easier for them to visualize that, okay, this bottle of Coke has a lot of sugar in it. Okay. So one of the most common examples of using mental models in the right way is actually how car companies communicate efficiency of vehicles. So for the longest time, we always used to talk about kilometers per liter, but it took a while for companies to realize that what customers would actually do is a reciprocal of that. They would calculate liters per kilometer because they pay for the liters. So then they would multiply that by the price. Now, after like a few decades, companies have started communicating it as liters per kilometer. So I think the lesson, broader lesson here is to think about communication in customers' mental models and not the mental models of the person who's actually doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think this again relates to the curse of knowledge, because companies likely to have that sort of domain knowledge whereby they are more interested in kilometers per liter because that's mileage and that's a good efficiency metric for them. But you know, the point that you made about icons and wayfinding, that is something that I see applied to several places, especially in, you know, subway systems, in transport systems, in transport places like railway stations. I think especially in the Western world or in the developed world, that is that's already something that's used pretty pretty well.
Yeah.
But my favorite application of that is actually an IKEA user manual.
That's interesting.
It's remarkable because any IKEA product, like let's say, even if it's like a really complex piece of furniture that you have to build, there's not a single word in any language. They only use symbols.
That's very interesting. So that's actually sort of going back to our idea of a shared culture of icons only.
Exactly. And this is such a huge advantage for a company like IKEA, because they, I don't know how many countries they export to, but I'm sure it's more than 50 countries. And this saves them a lot of overhead. And think about this, Preeti. Have you seen those user manuals where all of the, I mean, all the languages go one after the other? Just imagine 50, like a 50 page book like that, where only one page interests me. That is so sloppy from a design perspective. And it's so elegant to just have like that one universal page of symbols, right?
Yeah. And I think a direct implication of that is actually how tech companies use icons. So most tech companies do not need to depend on a user manual. You can download an app and straight away start using it without actually knowing anything about the app or the software or how it operates. Just by using icons, you can actually find your way around any application.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So let's move on now. And thanks to these icons, we've gotten to the security check well on time. What interests you as a behavioral scientist here?
I think one of the interesting things about a security check is there is a dichotomy there between the person who's doing the security check and the traveler who's going into it, because they have different perspectives on why they're entering the security check. For the security staff, it's imagine the plight of a security staff. You're like through a day pushing like thousands and thousands of trays in, and like that's your only job, right? That's what you're doing. At the same time, you have to be vigilant. But from a customer's perspective, he doesn't care that thousands of people have gone through that before. He's the only person walking in. And from his perspective, anything that goes here or there, if somebody makes you stay for 2 minutes extra, it becomes an issue and people start talking about, and that can like mar your entire flying experience. So I thought that's like a very interesting perspective that I never thought about personally. I never ever thought about security personnel till I started thinking about this whole aviation journey. And I thought that was something very different.
Yeah. I mean, I think the aspect that you mentioned about how they do a job which is very mundane, but at the same time, they have to be super vigilant.
Yeah.
Is one of the, makes it one of the most challenging jobs, actually.
Yeah. So one interesting study I read recently, it was this, there's this company in Denmark called iNudge, which actually does behavioral design. So they came up with this whole thing called action choreography. So the idea basically is that if you align things in a certain way, you're literally choreographing people's actions, which is basically behavioral design. So they did this study at the Copenhagen airport. And the problem they were trying to solve was that security staff complained that they were fed up with helping travelers push that tray through the X-ray scanner. Now, you think that's a really small thing, right? Like you're standing there and you're expecting somebody to push the tray for you. But if you look at it from a security staff's perspective, they push more than 100 trays per hour at the luggage gate. And this is equivalent literally to pushing the top shelf of a dishwasher machine every day, every minute, all year round. Wow. That's the amount of effort it takes. So what this company did was they decided to just sit around and observe how this happens, how this action is currently being choreographed. And they found it very fascinating that while the security staff thought that they were actually accelerating the flow in busy periods by stepping in and, you know, pushing the tray forward, they actually, when they observed and they noticed the time, they realized that it was making no difference to the time that it takes. So the acceleration, right, which was actually going on was just in the security staff's mind that they were actually helping this process. It was just a feeling of control that they were getting. When you actually measure the times, they realized that 69% of the tray, 69% of the times they had to push a tray. But if they kept their distance away and they did not do anything, there was actually no negative effect on the flow speed. So this whole consultancy was engaged to make the process better. At the end of the day, the only suggestion they gave them was keep your control instincts under control. Don't go forward and push and things will be just fine.
Wow, that is fascinating. So it's the problem actually lay elsewhere, like probably the bottleneck in the process lay elsewhere and not in terms of getting the pushing the trays out.
Yeah, exactly. The only problem was that security staff felt the need to go and push because they wanted to have a control over the system.
And I mean, like one of the aspects that really stands out to me because of the uniformity and the standardization that aviation is has adopted, even a 1% improvement in any process can scale to millions of dollars, probably even billions of dollars very easily.
Yeah. And the other thing is also that in this particular case, the behavior of the staff also influences what the passengers do.
Exactly.
If the staff is stepping forward and pushing the tray, then the passenger thinks it's his right to not go forward and push the tray. But if the staff does nothing and stands back, then the passenger will actually push the tray.
So moving on to from the security check and past the security check into the shopping areas, you know, like we said, we always feel a sense of excitement, whether that's positive or negative. And I think a lot of the shopping or the duty-free shopping stores and how they are organized in the airport kind of plays into this reality, right?
Yeah. Yeah. One of the fascinating things I learned about was that and after I learned about it, I thought back to all my airport visits and I realized it's very true. So as soon as you finish your security check and before the duty-free shopping starts, there is an area where there'll be chairs, there'll be place where you can sit and, you know, pack back your things into the bag, you can put on shoes. And while you're doing all that, you're basically staring at the duty-free space. So that's actually apparently called a recomposure zone because customers need to be stress-free to be able to shop. And a security check is a little bit of a stressful process. So from there to getting them to the gates, the airport needs you to like calm down and, you know, feel good. That's why they have that zone where there'll be water and there'll be, you know, you can like actually sit down and relax for a few seconds. And while you're relaxing, the first view you get is that of the duty-free shops. So that once you're relaxed, you just walk in there and you start buying.
Now that you mentioned this, I think back on all the airports I've been to and I can already notice a stark difference between the start and the end of the security gate.
Exactly.
In terms of in the start, the chairs will be really, or the stools or the seating arrangement will be really normal. But once you finish, it is likely to be more plush and comfortable.
Exactly. And it was the exact same thing for me. After I read this, then I was thinking back and I could relate that to almost every airport I've been to.
And you can see how the lighting also changes, right? Like in the security check area, there's enough lighting. But once you go into the shopping area, it's a completely different kind of lighting. It's a different kind of tiles that are used there. And there's deliberately that sort of contrast, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that contrast goes back to, you know, a psychological concept that we discussed way back in first season, which is that it changes the context of location in terms of, yeah, it puts the traveler in a different state of mind by changing how the location looks.
Exactly. They want people to like change modes. Till
exactly.
Now you were in a stressful mode. Now you're in a shopping mode.
Yeah. And I think also the kind of items that are sold in duty free reflect these tendencies.
Exactly. I almost feel like they like looked into my mind and they know exactly what I'm going to do. So they will give a lot of salience to things like gifts and chocolates and things that you know you may not spend on outside, but you will definitely spend when it's put in a duty free setup.
So, moving on to boarding. I think boarding is one of those processes where, you know, there is not much of a ritual, and it's just something that everybody, including the airline as well as the passengers, want to get over with as soon as possible.
Yeah. I mean, there are a few rituals, like, for example, companies have started doing zone-wise boarding and things like that. Mm-hmm. One interesting study also done by the same company I had mentioned earlier, iNudgeU, was also action choreography at boarding. So they had this interesting problem to solve. So Copenhagen Airport had recently revamped, and they wanted to welcome Airbus 380 to the airport, which is generally operated by Emirates. So Airbus 380 in itself is a huge aircraft. And for boarding that, you need a certain number of bridges, which are actually not available at Copenhagen Airport, which means that they needed to find ways to efficiently get a lot of people on board, actually 600 passengers on board in the airplane within 30 minutes without having access to so many bridges. So they needed to think of ways you can actually choreograph that action so that everybody goes back in. And you want to do it without like chasing people around like sheep. So it has to be done in an efficient way. So they again did observations like I'd mentioned earlier. And one of the problems they realized, which now that you think about it, I'm sure all of us would have seen, is that a lot of travelers are not aware that they should show their passport and boarding pass when they get to the handler at the end of the line. It's written everywhere. It's shown everywhere. Someone or the other keeps shouting all the time, please have your passport and boarding pass in your hand. But when they actually did observational studies, they realized that a lot of people don't do that. So what they did was they put up these TV screens in the queues, which showed pictures instructing travelers that you have to show both documents. What I really love about this experiment is that this was a very, very small change to do, but it led to actually a huge impact. So per passenger, the average reduction was 1.08 seconds, which actually does not sound like a lot. But when you scale the result, it means this is 4.46 minutes for one aircraft. And for an Airbus 380, which needed to board in 30 minutes, cutting down time by 5 minutes is like 1/6, which is like a huge difference. And this was a very, very small change to do, but something that actually managed to convince Emirates to land at Copenhagen.
You know, I've been guilty of doing this myself, whereby I'm not ready with my documents when I'm going into the gate. And even though there are people shouting, it almost comes back to me, these scenes where I'm listening to a podcast, I'm in my own head.
Exactly.
And then I come to the gate and I realize, oh my God, I have to scramble. Then I step to the side and let somebody else go before me.
For me, the best part about researching for this whole episode is that I feel like if and when travel opens up again, I'm going to be a much better traveler because I understand things more from the perspective of the folks running the airport rather than me as a harried passenger.
And I'm coming to realize this as I'm speaking with you here, right here. But the nudge that you mentioned about the screens that show what people ought to do already, that I've also seen that in the security check area. Mm-hmm. And those are really effective and they are well-made cartoons. They are very elegantly made. So they draw your attention.
Yeah.
And they draw your attention even if you are listening to something. So it works very well.
That's true, yeah. In fact, I think in general, the assumption that people will always follow the instructions is overrated. But putting in these small nudges, either through pictures or through anything visual, actually would end up in improving the efficiency of a lot of things, whether that's a passport office or visas or for anything. I think in general, the idea of visually reminding people about instructions is actually very helpful.
Now that we've boarded the A380 and hopefully that I've, and thanks to the nudge, I've not wasted any time with the gate. Let's talk about the taking off and the landing part. You know, some of the rituals that we see happening there is if you are seated at an emergency exit, the flight attendant comes over to you and before the flight takes off, I mean, first of all, there is the safety procedure which everybody has to listen to, which serves as a reminder. But specifically for people seated at the emergency exits, there's a ritual where the flight attendant comes over and explains to them that they are responsible for opening the door and also explicitly asks them if they are ready to cooperate in the event of an emergency. And all of them are, then she takes the turn to go to every, or she or he takes the turn, takes turns to go to every passenger and get their explicit compliance. I think this is related to the concept of priming, where you get people in the state of mind to help already when the emergency comes in, and also you get their explicit compliance. Yeah. I think this, I feel like this idea can be used in several other places as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are a lot of experiments which have shown that priming people with their identity makes them more amiable to do certain things. I remember one very famous experiment on this was getting people to not lie about claims on insurance. So generally people tend to overclaim insurance. So one of the experiments that was done was where people were asked to sign an honesty claim at the beginning of the form and then fill up their claims. The other variant was where you fill up claims and then you sign. And they realized that when people are made to sign before they actually claim anything, people tend to they've been primed to be honest and they tend to stick to that self-identity and they claim, the overclaims are much lower because of that. So I think in general, having people to think about their identity before making them do a task actually makes them more suitable to do that task.
Yeah. And in the case of insurance claims, I can only imagine how much the impact of that small measure makes. And in terms of identity, here we have a commercial interest, but there are also other interests, like the sanctity of a system, perhaps, that you can apply this to. And I've seen Coursera doing this. And Coursera uses online certification and it uses an honor code to ensure that its students are not cheating during the exams that it administers. Have an honesty. Sorry?
That's a very interesting use case. I've never actually thought of that.
And there again, they are reminding people that they are honest people before they take the test. And once they do that, I'm sure that the likelihood that people are cheating is dropping drastically because they're doing that, just as a small reminder. Another thing that we see when you're talking about taking off and landing is the cabin lights, especially when the flight is landing and it's landing into an airport and it's evening or night, the cabin lights go dimmer. One other interesting aspect is when you go inside inside a aircraft and you lock your toilet, the light grows brighter. But I mean, both of those things might seem like arbitrary things that the aircraft is doing, but they actually have really meaningful reasons as to why they're happening. The cabin lights going dimmer is actually because, I read about this only when I was preparing for the episode, happens because once an aircraft lands in a dark place and for some reason, due to some emergency, the aircraft needs to be evacuated. The eyes of the people inside, the eyes of the passengers have to be adapted to a dimmer setting so that when they go out, they don't feel like, your eyes do take time to adapt to darkness, right? So they don't want that getting in the way of people evacuating the aircraft. So that's the reason. I mean, even that small aspect of your flight experience is so well thought of in advance. And that's the reason the cabin lights go dimmer.
Oh, I had no idea about that. I had a completely different reasoning in mind, but this makes a lot more sense.
And if this is not good enough, the reason why the toilet lights go brighter is because in a dark cabin, especially on long haul flights, if the toilet was extremely well lit at all times, and if the toilet door was open, this light could flood into the cabin and disturb the passengers, especially the ones who are seated next to the cabin.
Oh, wow. I didn't know they were so considerate, actually. These seem like really nice customer experience reasons.
This is like attention to detail on steroids.
Yeah, I always thought they were like technical reasons for doing this. I never thought that they were actually related to customer experience.
So, all right. So, Preeti, we've taken this, this journey from a non-place, from being seated inside an aircraft and hopefully going to a nice place. I know we're all looking forward to that, given that we've been cooped up in our respective cities for so long. What are your final parting thoughts on aviation, having done this episode?
Yeah, I mean, like I was saying earlier, right, I have learned so much that I feel like I'll be a much more considerate traveler. And it's almost like reciprocity playing out, because I feel like I never thought about the amount of thought that goes into designing either an airport or an aircraft experience. And the fact that they are being so considerate about my thoughts and my feelings, I feel like I should reciprocate and be a much better, much more considerate traveler if and when I get to do it in the future.
And, you know, it all comes together somehow. Because of the massive scale of aviation, even a small aspect of the experience can have a massive impact on, I mean, like if your flight is 1% better, if you feel 1% better about your flight, now if you scale that across every country where this is going, where this is happening, that actually increases the well-being of humanity by a substantial amount.
Yeah.
And that is why, most impressive aspect for me was the attention to detail that is paid in anything that happens in aviation design. And this not just manifests itself in the customer experience perspective, which we spoke about today, but also in terms of making aviation safe, which can be a topic for a completely new episode. But whenever you see something quirky, or even if you get annoyed by some aspect of your flying experience, just go ahead and Google it. You're sure to learn surprising things about the aviation industry by doing that.
Yeah, agree on that 100%.
On that note, that's it for today's episode. You'll find references and recommended readings for this episode at our LinkedIn page, linkedin.com/company/theworkbrain. With this episode, we're also wrapping up season 2. Thank you for joining us one other time. Incidentally, this brings us also to the end of the podcast. We've done 2 seasons of this podcast, and it is personally been a very enriching experience. However, given that each episode takes a lot of research and a lot of time, we are unfortunately unable to continue into another season. So we've decided to wrap things up, and we wanted to inform you. But Preeti, any last thoughts that you want to communicate to our listeners before we wrap up?
The only thing I can say is it's been a pleasure doing this, because I think I have learned a lot from doing this podcast, and hopefully from our discussions, we've managed to get some people curious about behavioral science. My only recommendation to people is to keep your eyes open, because there's behavioral science all around us. And if you are interested in learning more about it, keep reading, because there's a lot of research happening even as we speak. And there's a lot of things that are being uncovered about human behavior, which are very interesting and have applications in our day-to-day life. So stay curious and keep learning more. And if you are more interested, do connect with us on LinkedIn as well. And we're happy to engage with you offline.
You know, I personally resonate so much with what you just said here, given especially how the decade from 2010 to 2020 has panned out. For me personally, this is the decade where, you know, people like Richard Thaler got the Nobel Prize. We have the field of behavioral economics has come into the forefront, come into prominence more so than ever before. And classics like Thinking Fast and Slow have gotten established as classics in our leading libraries. For me, it wasn't like you said, Preeti, like everywhere you look, there's behavioral science. And doing this podcast has been an enriching experience because it has given me that lens to look at the world with a fresh pair of eyes, with curiosity at why things are the way things are and why we behave the way we behave. And that, therefore, it has been an enriching experience that was rewarding in and of itself. And it is our hope, and we've tried our best to make it so that through the experience, we also want our listeners to gain something. And we hope that has been the case. The engagement that we've gotten and the whatever we heard from you has been extremely enriching and surprising. Yeah, so this is Team Workbrain signing off. Take care, stay safe, and stay curious.